Big D Entertainment, in association with Dipsy Doodle Productions, presents the Dave Holly Hour. Brought to you by the Sky Lounge and Tea, XL Chiropractic, Quality Nails, and Books and Brews Pizzeria. The Dave Holly Hour features Sioux Empire arts and entertainment conversations and has been recognized by the Sioux Falls Stage Awards with a special distinction for promoting the arts. A true lover of arts, entertainment, good food, and fun times, including an occasional Jack Daniels. Okay, so a few Jack Daniels. Here he is, Dave Holly.
Welcome to the show about Sioux Empire arts and entertainment conversations. We have two great ones for you today. Magician Travis Nye, not only magician, also magic shop owner. Then, artist Claire Lockhart tells us about her style and even gives us a new art term to learn. That should be a class or something, shouldn't it? But a few things that we must take care of beforehand.
Time to grab your favorite beverage, lift it high, and toast it to being Thursday, a.k.a. Weekend Eve.
Hey, the weekend isn't around the corner, it's here!
So long, hump day and your frumpy way. We say hello to Thursdays with opening nights. The weekend is near and we can see the bright lights. Yes, Thursday, you're so hearty, we can't wait for Friday, so a day early, we start the party.
And if you live in the Sioux Empire, you are partying this week, and our toast goes out to Mother Nature. After freezing our tuchus aronis off for a week, we got back to seasonal. In fact, we even got above normal temps. The other day, we hit 55, in February. So that was nice because we could go outside without a jacket and not freeze those tuchus aronis off again or a second time, because that might lead to frostbite. Thank you, Mother Nature, for providing us a great week of weather, and the weekend should be that way for us as well. So we are thankful for that, because now we can just call you Mother Nature again, because last week we were saying, you mother. That's not the only thing that we do. If you're a first-time listener, we like to talk arts and entertainment, yes, but at the beginning of the show, we always have a couple of things. One's that toast for Weekend Eve. The other is this little segment.
Honorable mention.
Oh, yes, each week we give out a little honorable mention. Somebody that's made me smile, chuckle, laugh, guffaw. And this week's winner kind of did all of that in one shot, really. Jason Curry Olson and I have been friends for many years. He is one of the owners of Wood Grain Brewing Company. And Monday, after doing the conversations, the interviews for today's show, I went in and got a couple of things to go, and Jason happened to be there that day. And we start chatting up a little bit and so forth, and he says, you know what? He says, I've been looking back at some old pictures of us, you know, from like anywhere between probably 10, 15 years ago. And he says, you look younger now than back then. And I said, even with the gray? He says, oh, you've always worn gray well. So, Jason Curry Olson, one of the fine owners of Wood Grain Brewery in downtown Sioux Falls, you are this week's lucky winner of the coveted Honorable Mention Award. All right. Hey, later in the show, a very fun conversation, one of the most open art conversations you're ever going to hear, with artist Claire Lockhart. But up next, a magical time with Travis Nye.
Dr. Perry Langston and Dr. Corey Tooney know excellence is in you. That's why they provide you with excellent care at XL Chiropractic, improving your overall health in spirit, body, mind, and will. Get results the natural way. Arrange a consultation, 605-332-9235 or xlchiros.com. Excellent care for excellent people. XL Chiropractic, located at 4309 South Racket Drive in Sioux Falls.
With him, every day is a holy day. Once again, here is Dave Holly.
Welcome back to the Dave Holly Hour, everybody. It is so great to have this young man along with me. We've known each other for a few years now. He is a tremendous magician, and I got to tell him straight up, Travis Nye, when we saw your show a couple of weeks back, you aren't just a marvelous magician now. You're a great showman, too.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
And it's fun to see, you know, when people grow in a craft and so forth and in an art. And you certainly have come a long way in that regard. You know, you could blow anybody in town away with the magic that you do.
Right.
But, you know, to see you on stage, put it all together, that was a wonderful time. Thank you very much for allowing us to be at that. Yeah. And it was part of a date night. Now, you had a couple of those.
Yeah, I had five.
Right, yeah. And they went well.
Yeah.
So well, you're thinking of bringing it back now?
Yeah. You know, it was originally just planned to be kind of a date night thing for February, you know, synonymous with Valentine's Day, so on and so forth. And having to buy all the linens and the tables and the glassware, all that stuff, I figure I have it. It's only going to be cheaper on my end, and the demand was there, so I'm just going to probably do them every month. I think I'm planning on the last Saturday of every month to do those.
All right. And in the meantime, you've also been down to the Pavilion.
Yep.
They had the family grow on last weekend.
Yeah.
And as you were saying before we started this, that it was supposed to be a walk-around magic thing, but once you kind of start, people stop you, don't they?
Yeah, they do. It's tough. You know, I always have kind of like a home base where I can kind of reset and regather my thoughts and get rid of all the empty stuff in my pockets. And as soon as I went there and kind of stood there for about 5 minutes, everybody just came and sat down. And so I'm like, okay, I guess we're just going to do an actual show. And that's ended up pretty much being where I was the entire event.
Well, that's good, though, that you're swamped by kids or family members of all ages.
Yeah, I had a couple adults even kind of shadow me for, you know, about 45 minutes just seeing the same tricks over and over. I'm sure they're just trying to figure out how I was doing them.
Right, but yeah. That seems to be the popular thing for a magician to deal with, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. How many of them are close? When they're sitting there thinking, you know, when somebody actually says, oh, I know how you did that, give it a percentage. How many are right?
I would say probably about 40%.
Okay.
Most people overthink it, but even the ones that are right, I usually have another method, and I say, okay, let's do it again. And then they're still wrong. So
you can fool them that way.
That's right.
Were you going to be on that then? Fool us? Penn and Teller?
You know, I've continually tried, and I've talked to Darren Toon, the producer of the show, quite a bit, and he always emails me whenever they're about ready to do a new season. They've cataloged all my stuff, but never got the call back for
it. Okay.
So.
Well, we'll wish you luck on that then.
Yeah,
that would
absolutely
be great to see you on that.
It'd be fun.
Yeah, no doubt about that. So what got you into magic? How'd this all start?
Yeah, it's a fun story. You want the long or the short?
Well, this is a podcast. You don't have to put it in 5 radio minutes.
All right.
We can go as long as you'd like.
I like it. I like it. So basically, in a nutshell, the long nutshell, everybody gets a magic kit when they're a kid. I mean, that's just one thing that almost every kid gets. And if you didn't have one, I'm sorry. You need to get one now. And I can supply that, but we'll talk about that later.
That's later on in the show.
Yes, yes. So I had the magic kit, and of course, I didn't understand any of it. It was just very, you know, half-translated instructions from big box stores.
Well, not only that, but the instructions are in about a 3-point font, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. They're really, really tiny. And they're just very poorly written. The magic isn't there. It's just the trick,
right,
so to speak. And, you know, first time never seeing the tricks that came with it being performed, I just learned the methods, and I'm like, there's no way this is going to fool anybody. Mm-hmm. So I discarded most of the stuff. And later on, I seen my first actual magic show. And I was like, that is absolutely amazing. And I recognized some of those props because I was like, oh, I got a cheaper version of that in my magic kit. And I'm like, I should
Mine's
go back
made
and
of cardboard.
Them.
This one's made of wood and steel.
Right, yeah. And so, of course, I couldn't find many of the pieces and whatever. And so I started just practicing card tricks and coming up with my own card tricks. And for about 2 years, it was awful. My parents, you know, started out giving me that sympathetic, like, oh, that's amazing. And it wasn't. It really wasn't. Eventually, a kid came to my school from Russia, a foreign exchange student, and he taught me, or at first he showed me a magic trick, and it just blew my mind. It was just a card trick, and so I begged and begged and begged and pleaded for him to teach me how to do that trick, and of course he wouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
About 3 days before he went back to Russia, he taught me how to do it, and he said, before you perform it, promise me you're going to practice, and so I practiced for like 2 or 3 weeks straight. And I finally went and showed my parents and got like a real genuine reaction of amazement. Like they were blown away. And through their excitement and amazement, like I felt that same excitement too.
Right.
I felt like I just seen the magic trick myself. I felt that, like the same thing they were feeling in that moment. And as cheesy as it sounds, like to this day, I still recognize that as the real magic. Not the trick, but that's the magic. Yeah. Okay. And so honestly, moving forward, every time that I do a show, I still get that same feeling as though I'm like that 14-year-old kid when my audience reacts in a good way. And that's my motivation to just keep pushing and pushing and pushing and trying to make a better show.
So you said that not only did you learn this from a Russian young man that had come over.
You make it sound so suspect here.
I was thinking, my God, the CIA is going to be after me now, aren't they? But before that, though, you mentioned that you had made up some card tricks.
Yeah.
Do you still use some of that?
Some of it, yeah. I mean, as you know, there's some methods that are used that are used across many different tricks. There's only so many ways you can do something. Once you have those down, then you can still do those tricks. But the one that I do still use is the one that he taught me. I call it the Chris Pratt trick now because Chris Pratt did it on a late night talk show. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's my trick. That is my trick. And so that's how I open it and show it. Like, oh, can you show us the first trick you ever learned? I'm like, oh, the Chris Pratt trick. And then I have to tell that story, too. So that's fun.
That's a great way to tie everything in.
Yeah.
Modern times and so forth. And
right.
make it real, make it current, and make it your own.
Absolutely.
At the same time. Yeah. What do you think is the most difficult part of being a magician?
Getting people to care. Honestly, I mean, you can find somebody's card, you could change something into something else, make something disappear, reappear, but without getting an emotional connection, they're just going to ask, well, how'd you do that? Or they're going to come up with their own method and tell you right there without waiting a second, and they're just not going to care. They're not going to care about the magic part of it. They're just not going to want to see it again. They just want to know how it was done.
All right. So this date night show that you've been doing is about an hour to an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And you do quite a bit within that time frame.
Yeah.
When you sit down and get an idea for a show like that, mm-hmm. what does it take from start to performance?
Well, I've done a couple different themed shows. For instance, the date night show, priority number one was to make sure that when people came together, it felt like a date. So that the magic part wasn't even part of my thought process there. I knew I already had the tricks. I had the show. I just had to get people to feel like they were on a date. I want it to be special in that regard. And so having people sat at their own separate table, just a little bistro table, with the candles and the dessert and the drinks and the cards and stuff that we're going to interact with later, all these different things, I mean, that kind of set the stage already. It wasn't like a normal magic show where people are coming there like, oh, I'm going to figure this out. You know, I'm going to call him out. Can't fool me. They were already there in a welcome state to where they were already comfortable and relaxed. So with that being said, at that point, I considered doing a lot of tricks that involved, you know, like a Valentine's theme with flowers and like the snowstorms, things like
right.
that. Right. I thought about doing all these different types of magic tricks. But at the end of it all, I just thought, I'm like, you know what? Don't overthink this one. They're already there together, and that's all that matters with their significant other. They just want a fun evening. So really, I did the tricks that I always do in a lot of my different shows, but the banter and the interaction with the audience was really just ad-lib the whole time. Like, I just fed off the audience, and every show in that regard is different. So as far as planning the show, there wasn't a whole lot of planning. It's just winging it as I go.
So in the meantime, besides being a great magician, you become an improv actor.
Apparently, yeah.
Yeah. So you'll learn to do that, that's for sure. But like I said, again, a great show. And so I highly recommend, if you have not been out to see Travis in any form that he's performing, make sure you do. You're going to enjoy it. And, you know, it's interesting that you started off the conversation basically by saying, you know, at some point every kid gets some magic.
That's true.
Well, you know, our granddaughter, who's now 9, got one not this past Christmas, but the Christmas before.
Yeah.
Yeah, from Grandpa Dave. surprising, right? And so she really didn't do anything, but the last time that she stayed with us, then she brought it from her house.
Oh, very cool.
And we keep it now at Grammy and Dave's.
Yeah.
So that she can practice. And, you know, within a couple hours, we were able to put on about a 15-minute show for Grammy.
Yeah.
And it was the delight in seeing her do that,
yeah,
and the accomplishment is just such a big thing. Do you think that you know, one of the reasons, so obviously, you know, there's a magic industry that wants to get kids interested in,
right,
it and so forth. But do you also think that that's also just kind of a part of magic, is that, you know, it can take somebody that's maybe shy, our granddaughter isn't, but, you know, it can take that type of person and give them confidence.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was always kind of the class clown, you know, so I was always outgoing in that way, but put me on a stage and I wanted nothing to do with it, right? Like, I was not the talker. I was not in front of people. If I was, you know, in my own moment there, I'd just be silly and stupid, and that was fine. But as far as going out there and with a purpose and intentionally say, okay, I'm going to entertain you, that is completely different. So for me personally, I can speak about how the confidence had built up, because I'm like, okay, I'm deliberately going out there. I'm putting myself in front of everybody saying, this is what I'm going to do, and have the confidence to know that I can do that. And so when you were saying that my show is kind of built, my personality is kind of, mm-hmm, built, my stage presence is built, all that has come just from confidence of doing those shows over and over. Because early, you know, I was focused on the tricks. I wasn't focused on the audience. I wasn't focused on that interaction. And just the confidence of knowing the tricks gave me time to stop and have confidence in my show overall. And so that was a huge part. And for kids to be able to do that, not only does it help with their confidence in creating things and presenting things, but their communication and just the overall creativity of saying, this is what it does, but what else could I do with it? Or if you know basic magic, I want to make this thing disappear, how could I do that? You can create all that stuff if you know the basic surroundings around magic.
Yeah. And I guess I want to lead into that as well, because you also teach magic.
I do.
At your, yeah, shop.
Yeah.
And so, first of all, tell us about the shop, how it's going. It's not all that old.
It's not. No, I'm just rounding that 1 year mark. Mm-hmm. February is when I signed the papers for it. Opening date was March 25th.
In the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah, why not, right? Everybody questioned it, you know, is this something you're going to move forward with? Are you going to continue to do it? And I'm like, well, I've already signed the papers and paying rent, so I might as well try to make some money back. And I was nervous about it, but moving forward, it went great. I mean, I got a lot of shows that I wouldn't have had otherwise. So
true. And in the teaching aspect,
yeah,
have you had some in-house as well as online?
Yeah, I think I've probably had about 5 to 8 in-house classes, which went great. I think at most I had 12 kids in the class at one time. Other times, you know, it was just a couple, because I was playing with different times and days and stuff like that to figure out when kids and parents would be available. And I found evenings works best, even on the weekends.
Really?
And in the summer.
Yeah,
like
awesome.
I would have thought that, you know, afternoons on a Sunday would have been great, but nope.
What's the feedback been from, first of all, the kids, and,
yeah,
second of all, the parents?
You know, if I would have just said, here's a magic kit, let me know what you think of it, they would have never came back. But because I can be in front of them and present and perform the trick the way it's supposed to be, they get so much more excited about it in that moment, and they want to learn it, so they spend more time on it. And because of that, the classes that are 1 hour to an hour and a half usually extend quite a bit longer,
uh-huh,
because they're excited and they want to show me and all these other different things. But they've absolutely loved it, and they continually come back to the shop. And kids even, you know, sign up for the next class and the next class, even though they're going to learn some of the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I purposely say, okay, we'll do a brand new class this time, brand new tricks. If you want to come back, this is what it is this time. But no, it's gone great. And even the parents are loving it too, because, you know, this day and age, everybody's on their phones and playing video games and so on and so forth, that the parents are excited to see their kid actually want to do something else that requires a little bit of creativity and I don't want to say motor skills and dexterity, stuff like that, because video games do require that. But just off a screen, essentially interacting with somebody else, because if they're going to practice the tricks, they're not just going to perform it for themselves. They're going to have to eventually show somebody else.
And obviously it takes commitment too.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And it's fun seeing those few people that I can see that little spark of passion in, where I try to capture those individuals, because some kids just want to do it just because it looks fun and they never come back. And that's fine. That's what kids do. And that's even what I do today. But every now and then there's a couple kids that'll just be like, wow, this is awesome. I want to get this and this and this. And they come back and they call the shop continually. And so those I really try to grab a hold of and like nurture a little bit and say, like, this is what you need to do. Like, at some point, stop spending money, because you have everything that you need. Bring it in and let's work on it even more. And that's honestly the core reason why I opened the shop to begin with.
That's wonderful. And in the meantime, you said that you're going to maybe, you know, have some different classes as kids come back and so forth. Are you eventually going to have, you know, different levels of classes, you know, beginner,
I think that's
intermediate?
That's about where it's going to go, because I do have some kids that are popping up that are already doing magic for a couple of years that I didn't even know were in town, and they're showing me tricks that I didn't even know kids were doing. Even some adults, like, are coming in that are hobbyists and dabbling and stuff that, you know, I've found probably a dozen or so people of all ages coming in that's like, oh yeah, I've been doing magic for years, I've been doing this, and now do you have this, do you know about this person or this trick? And I'm like, where have you been? Like,
what's the toughest part of putting together a show?
I think it's, I mean, honestly, it comes down to not doing the same show over and over.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have someone who comes to every show. She comes to every show, buys every ticket. Well, not every ticket in a show, but buys every seat. It's just a show for her. No. And it's great, but I also feel bad. Like, okay, I need to change this up. I need to make it different. But talking to her, you know, off the side, out of the show, she's just like, no, I love it. Just keep it. Like, don't change it for me, because everybody else is going to love the thing too. But I overthink my shows, I think, too much. I constantly want to upgrade, do something new, but every time it feels like a new audience with the exception of one or two people. So I think as far as putting together a show, I mean, just stick with what I'm comfortable with and what I know, and that's going to deliver the best experience for anybody.
All right. Tell us the different types of magic you do then. You know, we mentioned the word walk around.
Yeah.
But we've been talking about a stage show. So give us an idea of, you know, the scope of your magic.
Yeah.
As to what it covers.
So, of course, I started out with close-up magic, you know, out-of-pocket stuff, cards and coins, things like that, sleight-of-hand stuff, because when I was young, I didn't have money. That's what I learned. That's what I'm comfortable with. If you want to hire me for a show, that's the show that I try to push the most. I also do stand-up shows, which is, you know, for instance, like at the theater, it's a parlor show, it's a parlor theater. I can do a mix of that close-up and stand-up stuff where you wouldn't get in a full-size, like, theater-size show or a couple hundred people show. And then I do those larger shows as well. Now, there's not any illusions. It's kind of that pack small plays big idea, mm-hmm. where really I play off the audience, and you don't need the big giant illusions and things like that to entertain a crowd. I mean, you know that through improv,
right.
And comedy. And I mean, really, it's about that experience and connecting with the people. But to go one step further, I do some stunts as well, like the fire eating. I do that, needle swallowing, walking on glass, eating light bulbs, all the stuff that people want to know why I do it.
Okay.
To make you question.
Oh, all right. So you answered it already. You took away one of my biggest questions.
No. truth is, I like it, like the needle swallowing act that I do. I closed a show for a long time with that routine because it kind of blurs the line of, like, that could be possible. Like, where are they going? What is he doing? And then when I eat a light bulb in the beginning of the show, like, did he really eat the light bulb? Did he really swallow the needle? Like, some of that stuff is actually real. Like fire eating, you can't fake fire. Okay. It's hot. It burns. It
there is
terrible.
No gimmick there.
No. So I think weaving some of those things that are still amazing or mind blowing to some people that are real mixed with magic, it kind of blurs that line of where they can't follow along 100% as to, okay, was that a trick or was that real type of thing?
What do you aspire yet? I mean, you've got your own magic shop. It has a theater in it. What aspirations does Travis Nye, the magician, have at this point?
You know, right now, I think the next goal I have, one is to continue with the shop and the theater and make sure that stays alive and healthy and well. I already have the mindset of, you know, like 10 years, 15 years down the road that this here is a landmark in Sioux Falls. People will just know that it's here. It's a destination spot. So I have that legacy mindset now, which is great. The location that I'm at is not ideal. I have a casino on both sides of me, a Burger King, a Little Caesar, a Mexican restaurant. People don't go there to shop. Now, I never want my place to feel like a shopping experience. It should just be an experience in general. But I need to go where there's more foot traffic. And so when I make that change, I would like my theater to be the focus over the shop, I think,
mm-hmm.
just because the ticket and show demand is there, and there's nothing else like that here in town.
A rentable theater as well?
Absolutely, which mine is now. I've had a few people mm-hmm. come in there and use it and do different things, which is fun.
Excellent. Well, I'm just thinking of a show that you've been involved in before.
Yeah.
We could maybe do that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Where do you think people are going to be thinking in terms of what magic should be in that time frame of 10, 15 years down the road?
Yeah, as far as the show or?
As far as what we envision for illusions and so forth, because it seems like they try to get more dangerous. They try to, big, spectacular.
Yeah.
But what's going to happen?
It's funny because I went down that road for a while of always constantly buying the newest, biggest, best thing that was out there. And it's fun. But again, I go back and I'm like, I'm going to perform a couple of these classic routines that I usually don't do. They're fun to do, but nobody seems to really care about them. But when I perform them, it gets the best reaction because nobody has ever seen them again. It's that classic saying of what is old is new again. Right? Yeah. And so I really want to go back and just try to reinvent some of those classic tricks. For instance, even some of the linking ring routines where they're all flashy moves and spins and flips and catches and all that stuff. Now that'd be fun to do with a cups and balls routine. Update that, almost mix it with a bartender experience, a flashy bartender tosses and stuff like that. That'd be really fun to do. I think one thing lacking in a lot of magic shows is it's always just kind of trick after trick after trick, and stage shows are definitely guilty of that.
Right.
With the parlor show, I have that moment I can connect with people, and I really want it to be a story-based experience. One thing that I'd like to do, and maybe we can connect with this and work on it, but I wanted to create almost those old books where you could actually read so far, and it'd give you a choice of what path you want to take, and it'd tell you what page to go to. I want to create a magic show like that, where the audience is essentially choosing the next routine that I perform. and then that will change the outcome of the entire show.
I love it.
And so even doing a murder mystery show where some of those effects would be a part of the show, like they're picking the next part of the play.
Wow.
Yeah, that's intriguing.
You've been thinking about this, haven't you?
I have, yeah. That was honestly going to be a goal for October for those Houdini shows that I did, but I just couldn't put it together the way that I wanted to.
Well, and I'm sure that COVID prevented. You've done well despite COVID.
I agree.
But it's probably not as well as you could have done if we wouldn't have had it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and that's my thing. I keep telling myself and everybody keeps telling me that if I've made it this first year through all of COVID, it's going to just do nothing but succeed once it's lifted.
So. And we look forward to that. In the meantime, we talked about what got you started, but who did you look up to? Those first magicians and even now?
Yeah, so, starting out, I didn't really know any magicians or anything like that. There was none that I knew personally in my small town that I grew up in Iowa. The first magician that I ever actually got inspired by was Lance Burton.
My favorite.
I know. He was, the dove and candle act that he does. That was the first time I had ever watched a real magic performance. And it was just on TV during World's Greatest Magic. Early 90s aired Halloween weekend for a two-night special. And all of the magicians that came out there and showcased their talents, whether they got a 10 or 15-minute act, whatever it was, were amazing, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And every year I stayed up to watch that, and I even recorded it on VHS tapes, I think.
Still have them?
I wish. I wish. They're so hard to come by now.
Yeah, no doubt about that.
Yeah, and then Lance came on, and it just floored me. It blew me away. I mean, to this day, I still watch that performance over and over again.
I'm guessing you've probably met him too.
I have, yeah. I actually got about 45 minutes. I got sat down with him in Des Moines, Iowa. He did a red carpet showing at a convention there, so I got to sit down with him for a while. And then even through my shop, I've been interviewing a lot of bigger name magicians, and so he spent 2 hours with me doing a live interview.
That's great.
Yeah, it was fun.
Carrie and I met him one time out in Las Vegas after his show.
Very cool.
Fellow magician from town had lined it up, and it was, the treatment.
Yeah.
The whole time, come up here and just stay here. We will have someone escort you afterward. It was all well done, but it was what was really fun to see. And I know this is a huge, big box type of show that he has, but he does it so incredibly well, and he is a phenomenal entertainer.
Yeah.
By then all the curtains are drawn back and so forth, and I'm sitting there going, that's bigger than a football field worth of stuff all the way down to the back of the building.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow. So that was fun to see it in that regard. But you know what was great about you know, what he talked about with me was the fact that, you know, keep kids interested in magic, and you are doing that so well.
Thank you. Certainly
appreciate it, and another great thing for the community to have, as you mentioned.
So I
always ask two follow-up questions at the end, and sometimes they're answered right away the first one. But so when you're not entertaining others, what do you like to be entertained by?
As an entertainer, you're always smiling, always presenting, always having energy. I just like to sit down and just watch a show. like I just like to mellow and not be around all the noise and just relax. Like, that is the best thing for me. I do watch a lot of documentaries and stuff like that on Netflix, and a lot of just dead TV episodes that, you know, are ancient, like a Bob Newhart show, stuff like that. Like, I love
good
it.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I suppose you kind of answered the last question then of any other hobbies.
Oh, you know, I just, not really. I mean, I'm pretty busy with the magic stuff. Thankful for being as busy as I am, especially during this time. I do hold another full-time job doing donuts. That's another passion of mine, or becoming a passion of mine. And outside of that, spending time with my family. That's about it.
Excellent. Well, glad you could spend some time with us, Travis.
Absolutely.
Travis Nye, magician. How do they get a hold of you?
Oh, you can either reach me at the Magic Shop right there, Spellbound Magic Shop and Theater, 41st and Marion Road here in Sioux Falls. You can go to my website, magicoftravisnye.com. Shoot me a message, info@magicoftravisnye.com, or just find me on Facebook.
Excellent. Appreciate it. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more of the Dave Holly Hour in just a moment.
Ladies, when it's time to give your nails some love, get that extra special treatment from Quality Nails on South Minnesota Avenue in Sioux Falls. Manicures and pedicures that look great and make you feel fantastic. Zaya and Tony provide professional care for your hands and feet, whether you just want the basics or an extra special look with added flair. Oh, and guys, it's okay to treat yourself too. Quality Nails. Call for an appointment. 605-334-1463.
The Dave Holly Hour. Like eavesdropping on a great conversation between two very interesting people.
Welcome back to the Dave Holly Hour, everybody. It's a nice thing that we have so many varieties of art to take in and around our community, in and around Sioux Falls, in and around the greater Sioux Empire. And this time around, we're going to talk visual arts as we bring in Claire Lockhart. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. And I've been seeing your stuff online quite a bit. I know you've got a show that's up right now at the Washington Pavilion. And it's like, wow, I really like this. How do you describe your artwork?
Weird. Well, it's complex, but the artwork that I have on display at the Washington Pavilion right now is from my Brodolesque series. And for people who are unfamiliar with what an odalesque is, imagine from art history all of those lounging, swooning women on sofas,
mm-hmm.
who are usually not dressed.
Yeah.
And I am addressing that concept in art history, where we see, you know, nude women mm-hmm. in artwork, and we just are supposed to accept it as normal and everyday. And so to challenge that, I am painting bros in those same kind of settings. So imagine, you know, your favorite dude lounging on the sofa in front of his video games or TV, and has like chips and candy and wrappers all over. And I paint in a very realistic, representational mm-hmm. way too. So it looks like they might belong in those museums, but they're very contemporary with the settings and technology and clothing, of course.
Isn't that one of the great things about art, though, that you can take, you know, the traditional, mm-hmm. combine it with the contemporary, and basically find your own niche?
Yes. And then, I mean, art history has such a long past. I mean, human beings invented art before we even invented agriculture. So there's always something to engage with.
What do you like best about being an artist?
I enjoy having a way that communicates with people, whether I am in the room talking to them, or I can create my artwork and someone can go see it without me there and still be able to understand my message or my humor.
So the type of art that you were just describing to us, how did you get started on that? What was the impetus that brought that about?
There are so many factors in it, but I think one of them is in my studies and travels, there is that overwhelming sense of women are models and men are the artists. And if you're familiar with the Guerrilla Girls, so they made that poster in 1989 where it was, do women have to be naked to get into the Met? And that's where they analyzed and saw that the vast majority of artists on display were men, whereas like over 80% of all the nudes were women. And so that and other historical factors have just kind of trickled in. It's like, I need to address this and like correct those statistics. So I'm a woman artist. I'm painting men. They're not nude, though. I do use khakis as a as a metaphor for the nude, but so it's a show that you can bring children to. You won't be harmed by it. And so between all of this different research and then reading Edward Said's Orientalism and Linda Nochlin's The Imaginary Orient, and it just culminates into this big ball of frustration, which I let out in my paintings that hopefully people find humorous and can interact with.
Well, from what I've seen, I really am thrilled by what I take a look at. It's, for one thing, you know, it's got some color to it. It's got some imagination to it. I love the detail is in there. It's really unique. And what's been fun is on your Instagram, to be able to kind of watch the flow of it.
Oh, yes.
And does that, you know, kind of go against what an artist typically would be, you know, where they're like, oh, I'm going to do my art and I'm going to show it and hopefully somebody likes it. Whereas this is, I'm doing my art. You take a look at it and help me out here.
I am not a magical artist who hides behind the concept of talent. Art is hard. It's really hard. Mm-hmm. It's difficult. It's challenging. And I have over a decade of experience as an art educator. I've taught everyone from junior kindergarten up through graduate school. And I never lie. I never hide anything. I'm like, this is how I problem solved it. And that's why I've been successful as a teacher. And so my Instagram account and my Facebook postings is just kind of an extension of that. I'm not worried about like having some mystique about me. No, I worked hard. I spent 150 hours on this painting. Right. I want credit for it. Yeah. Appreciate me.
Reminds me of a great story that I heard a friend of mine back in my radio days. He had been to his hometown county fair, lived up in originally from Wilmer, Minnesota, Kandy Ohi County Fair, I think it's called. And
I think I caught a goat at that fair one time. I'm kidding.
But anyway, he saw an old gentleman that he knew from town that was a wood carver. And he told me that the wood carver had this beautiful eagle or bird. I can't remember what. I want to say it was an eagle, though. But and then he saw the price tag. And he said, well, how long did it take you to do this? And the gentleman said, 37 years. Because that's how long I've been wood carving. And that's why it has a price tag, because that's what you pay for to get quality and so forth. So I love that about, you know, hey, give me some respect here. You know, let me own this and so forth. Yeah. All right. So what was the first art thing you ever did and what age were we?
Oh, I have no idea.
You know, because we all draw. You know, we have crayon and so forth. But at what point do you kind of go, yeah, that's where I thought.
Can I just establish a mythology that I sprung fully formed out of the head of Frida Kahlo, and that's my origin story?
Do it.
No, I honestly don't know, but I feel like I didn't actually make a successful work of art until I was at least a year into graduate school, because it was then when I noticed that transition from making things that are decoration and then making things that actually communicate or have a message. So that transition, that epiphany. And so I was probably, I mean, that was only a few years ago too. Like I went to graduate school to learn how to paint because that was my least skilled area. And I didn't know that when you went for an MFA, you were already supposed to be like an established artist in your field, because I was coming out of the education tradition. And the master's degree in education is different than the intensity and full-time levels as the MFA is. And so it was being in that intense program, having supportive instructors, and then finally being able to like, okay, now I get it. This is kind of what art is.
So where did you do your studies?
I did my MFA at the University of South Dakota in Vermilion.
Okay. All right. And so you were saying, you know, we talked a little bit about, hey, I've got 150 hours in this. I'm assuming there were a lot more hours in your MFA.
Oh, yes.
And give us an idea of what kind of a drudge that is then.
It's so much work, but it's incredibly rewarding. Like I was in my studio or on campus. I also taught a little bit at the same time, but I would work 10 to 14 hours every day, either painting, printing, or researching and also teaching. So it was just living and breathing art. So it's like a very cruel, intense environment, but I learned so much and grew so much that I wouldn't have changed it if I could.
What do you appreciate about the art that you do?
I really like being able to express my sense of humor with my art. I do take art very serious, and especially when I see lack of representation within the art world. Like, I know women aren't collected as much and their artwork isn't monetarily as valued, but it's like, I'm a working woman artist. If you know statistics bad, just buy some stuff from me. Ha ha. But I like it when people can connect with my artwork, when they see it and then they feel either inspired to tell me a story that it reminds them of, like when people comment on my Instagram feed. I just love that, and being able to have a conversation with people I wouldn't have never met in real life.
What do you think is most misunderstood about modern art?
Are we talking modern art with a capital M or contemporary art being made right now?
Contemporary.
Ah, it's because I also teach the history of modern art, so I'm very pedantic and professory. With contemporary art, I really dislike the notion that artists have to suffer for the audience. And it reminds me a lot of like the story with Vincent van Gogh and how we like the notion that, oh, he suffered and that's why he made great art. And that's not the case. Despite like his challenges and mental illness, he was able to overcome it and create great art. And I just feel really sad, like if his life wouldn't have ended so short, imagine all the paintings he could have made. So that, I know that's modern art with a capital M and not the contemporary art, but there's still that burden that artists are supposed to suffer and then put it on display for people's entertainment. I actually made a series of prints last year and ran it through Kickstarter, and it was called Claire Skull, where I took a CT scan of my actual skull and printed it on different things and like canvases, and I made stickers and stuff like that too, but it was a joke on the look, I suffered, here's my art.
Yeah, it's one of those situations where you want to say that this artist was just a happy-go-lucky person in their life. Yeah. They didn't have to suffer for anything. What is it that you were talking about, the fact that when you went into your MFA, you had come more so from the educational, and with that painting not being your strong suit, what were your strong suits in art?
Well, I'm also going to back this up further, too. And when I got my bachelor's degree, I knew I was going to be into debt up to my eyeballs, and I wanted to get my money's worth in school. And I was thinking, what do I know the least about? Well, I don't know anything about art. How would I devote my life to that? And so I'm a person who loves challenges and having all of these like problem-solving abilities. And so I did a lot in sculpture and ceramics because those were things I had never, ever done before. And then when I taught, I had to teach everything. So I did teach painting, but I am such a stronger teacher now, especially with my ability to actually paint and create real art, the capital A now.
Do you think that art is too segmented, or do we need more segmentation of, you should really take a sculpture class? Mm-hmm. You know, when you get to college and grad school and so forth, but basic, high school and lower art classes, is it too much that it's a quote-unquote art teacher?
Well, when I would develop curriculum, and I'm a huge curriculum nerd and love making lessons and everything, I try to have like a balance so there's an experience of something that is 3D, something that is flat. But I always based on my curriculum on drawing and also art history, because the context and the cultural resources are just very important to have. So that way, when people create something, it has a message, it's meaning, it's connected to history. But I feel drawing is that foundation that you need to have, because if you can make a good drawing, you can plan a good sculpture, you can make a great print, you can do a painting, and all of these other areas that branch off of it. And I do think it is important to have an actual art class in arts in school, because we have like a science class and a reading class and math, and art was invented before all of those things. So,
well, and the thing is, you know, if you're going to be an architect, you better know something about drawings.
Right. Or yeah. How many times have you seen someone get like a really bad tattoo and you're like, I wish you would have taken Art 1 in high school.
Well, it's funny because we record here in the lobby between Agua Fresh and Wood Grain. And so we look outside here and we see so much architecture and, of course, art. As well. So really, art is in anything.
It's everywhere. Did you see, I saw this meme where they did a statistic and they polled people and said, what is the least essential job? An artist was top.
Oh, my.
But it was an infograph. Like, an artist had to design that after they were told by their community that they don't matter.
When you decided that you're going on to grad school, you got to pick up the painting skills and so forth. Nervous?
Oh, yes. It was so intimidating because, as I said, I didn't know that I was supposed to already be an artist when I went there. And I actually did not get into graduate school the first time I applied. I applied to several different schools. I was rejected by everybody. But the head of the department at USD reached out to me and told me what I could do to be a stronger candidate the next year. And so I worked really hard over that year to show that I'm teachable. Now, my portfolio was really embarrassing. It's like not at all the quality that I can do now. But I got in and it was like, they let me in. I can't let anybody down. So that really motivated me to work very hard.
Now, obviously, with the experience that you have now from that, that goes into the teaching as well.
Yeah. And I am phenomenally a better teacher than I used to be, because I can engage with all these different themes and topics in art at such an intellectual level that I was completely unaware of. And right now I'm actually teaching the history of modern art, and I'm doing that down at Morningside, and it is just delightful to be able to roll in all of these extra things other than just memorize this artist made this in this year, but pulling in the culture and the philosophy and the criticism, not only from that time, but how it affects contemporary life too.
How many artists are out there that we don't know about?
Schmillions
even, huh?
And that's unfortunate, because one of the things that I've been on a tirade lately, especially with the art world, is we have like four artists that we all know and adore, and their artwork is worth more money than I can even count to. But we have all these local artists that are making fantastic, impactful, wonderful things. And it would just be great if we had like a new renaissance of Medici's purchasing artwork from contemporary artists and adding it to their collections and valuing it as much as these people that we were told by our teachers, who were told by their teachers, who were told by their teachers, were the valuable artists.
And there certainly is great value in having local art. You know, it's been such a fun thing. I grew up down in Rock Rapids. Sioux Falls was the big city to come to. And now living here for a quarter century and having seen how everything has progressed, you know, because there are places I go now that, you know, 15, 20 years ago weren't here or, you know, that long ago, maybe just didn't go, is it really worth going into? You know, whereas now you've got so many different venues, so many opportunities for art of all kind. And so that hopefully broadens that spectrum of getting more local artists, more known artists, more local artists being known is really what I'm getting at.
Make me famous. Yeah.
Well, that's what we're trying to do right here. So you get into the Washington Pavilion, mm-hmm. and, you know, so thousands of people are going to be seeing you now.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first show that you had where you knew it was going to be a crowd versus just a few people that liked your stuff?
I always would go to like receptions and artist talks and like, oh no, I hope someone shows up. And I've always had a pretty good crowd, especially as I display as a solo exhibition mm-hmm. artist too. I almost said solo exhibitionist. I'm like, no, that's the wrong word. Nope.
It's a family show.
But when I exhibit my artwork as a solo artist, I've had some fantastic crowds, and it's just so fantastic and amazing to see not only like my friends or former teachers or colleagues show up, but just other people within the community come out to see, like they saw the poster or got the postcard or saw an invitation online and came out to see it. And it's so nice to be part of a supportive community. I love it.
What's the typical question that people that aren't in the art industry mm-hmm. but enjoy art and come to your receptions and so forth that they ask?
Well, the artwork that I've displayed most often is my Feminine Attempt series, and those are life-size portraits. They're 6 to 7 feet tall canvases that I made where they look like Betty Crocker meets Betty Page. So it's these archetypical like 1950s housewife outfits, but they're wearing big, provocative, intimidating footwear. And when I display that artwork and I show up and I'm wearing, you know, comfortable shoes, they're like, well, why aren't you wearing the boots? And it's like, oh, I have to stand up. So it's kind of interesting when I would display that body of artwork, people would think that's how I dress normally.
All right. So you've got your paintings that you do and quite well. Mm-hmm. And then you've also got the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about the fact that, you know, if you can draw and start there,
yeah.
then the other disciplines can come along mm-hmm. and so forth. What are you doing besides the painting?
Well, on the time that I have free time.
Yeah.
I do engage in other forms of art as well. Mm-hmm. I do printmaking as well. Like my biggest project was I was part of the Her flag.
Okay.
And so that is a 26-foot wide flag that was conceived of, organized, and assembled by Maryland artists. And it was a celebration of the 19th Amendment. And so I was picked to represent the whole state of South Dakota for this.
Wow.
So I made a flag stripes 26 feet wide, and I did the printmaking for that, so it's mm-hmm. silkscreen, and that is like another branch of what I do. But I feel like I just don't have any. Who has free time?
Yeah.
Sometimes I sleep.
Yeah.
And I like eating candy.
Yeah.
I know, I'm really deep, aren't I?
Well, candy, you got me.
Yeah, oh
you
gosh.
Know the old line, you got me a candy. Who do you admire around this area for art?
Well, I should probably say the people that are in that exhibition with me first.
True.
Of all.
Yes.
So that show is called 75% Packard, 25% mm-hmm. Lockhart, and there's four people in it. And so I'm the Lockhart in that.
You're the 1/4.
In that show, it's my husband, Aaron Packard,
mm-hmm.
and he has some amazing photography in there. And he has his series called Epically Masked, which he started this summer as a reaction to the pandemic and promoting health and safety for everyone. So he took pictures of people in South Dakota in outdoor environments, but lit them with artificial light. So it's very clear and crisp, and it's just showing the heroic nature of everyday people. And these pictures are like 2 by 3 feet. They're huge. So it's so much better to see those in person. And then his mom, Phyllis, is in this exhibition too. And she's a fiber artist. She's been creating tapestries for over 50 years. And she combines all these great vivid colors, and she literally weaves together these textures and creates South Dakota sky and land. And then the third artist in this exhibition is Anna Packard. So that's Aaron's sister. And she's a design instructor at Kearney at the University of Nebraska. But she created these wonderful portraits of machines. It's really vibrant and vivid. It's kind of like if a Fauvist artist was making robot paintings. So I should say, those are some artists around here.
Definitely.
Admire, so
yeah, if you don't admire the relatives, you might be in trouble.
No, I really lucked out. I have such a fantastic family that I married into. And before we got married last year, I joke like they had to see my CV and my exhibition record to prove to let me in.
when you get into the studio, do you have any rituals or anything that get you pumped up instead of, you know, because we hear about writers, oh, I just can't write today, writer's block. do painters have that?
Yes.
And what do you do to overcome
it? I do multiple paintings at a time.
Okay.
Because part of it is if I'm stuck on something and I need to problem solve, I can't sit there and stare at a canvas while time ticks by and I've got stuff to do. And I also do that just so I have dry time because I paint with oils. And sometimes I need to wait a day or even up to a week before I can add the next layer without messing it up. So when I have multiple canvases going at once, I always have, if I'm feeling stuck, something in the back burner. And then I have like ideas for what my next compositions will be. So either sketches or flipping through like an art history book for my inspiration, especially with the Brodalesque series, since I'm specifically fighting, addressing, challenging. Let's use challenging. Okay. Challenging Orientalist painters from 19th century France.
How do you feel about your art at this point, and how do you want to progress from it?
So I'm really excited to continue on painting more bros. I actually received the Elizabeth Greenshields Foundation Award. It's an international grant, and I got it to help fund to create more Brodalesque paintings. So this year will definitely be a buckle down and get more of these done because I actually have an obligation to do it. But I'm very excited to be able to create enough of them that I could do a solo exhibition with them instead of just a group show.
So the word we need to think of from now on, Brodalesque.
Brodalesque. Did I explain what an odalesque was earlier?
Yes, you did.
Okay.
Yes, we had that. And okay. Then you said, and I brought the bros into it and changed it. But I'm just thinking, you know, we hear about, you know, the Renaissance. We hear about Impressionism, Realism, etc. But Brodalesque. That's the one we have to put into our lexicon now.
Yes.
Because that's what we'll see.
I can't wait to see it in the index in some art history books someday.
Well, and since you teach it, you'll be talking about yourself then.
Oh, yes. That'd be weird.
Well, Claire Lockhart, it's been a pleasure getting to know you. Thank you for coming up here and being able to sit down and chat about your art. And I know that you're busy, so certainly appreciate the time. And best of luck to you the rest of the way.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. And we'll be back to wrap up the Dave Holly Hour in just a moment.
Sure, they have darts, and you've heard me talk about how ruggedly handsome the trivia host is, but all caps fun never stops at the Sky Lounge and Tea. And fun is best had with your friends enjoying live entertainment, as in live and local. Yeah, the Sky Lounge believes in giving you the best bands, solo artists, and comedians from the area. The Neo Johnsons, Elizabeth Hunstead, Skylar Volks, as well as many others. And a great staff will make sure you enjoy your fun at the Sky Lounge in T, South Dakota.
From the Dipsy Doodle Studios at the world headquarters of Big D Entertainment, a 40-square-foot home studio in the middle of America, it's Dave Holly.
Hey, thanks again for listening. Certainly appreciate it. Not just the listening, the downloads and so forth, but also when you're going to Facebook or Instagram, Twitter, yeah, on all three of those platforms, and you give me a like or a share, it means a lot. And don't forget, you can always find out more about the show at DaveHollyHour.com. You can also find out more about my other entertainment gigs at DaveHolly.com. So thank you for doing that. Also, thank you to our guests this week, magician Travis Nye and artist Claire Lockhart. Those were fun interviews. And by the way, coming up next week, talk about a man that is on a roll right now. We've had, you know, Matt D, Brady Reed, and Ben Gertner on to talk about their music. Well, their music gets recorded out at the Warehouse Recording Studio. Got to tour that last week along with Mark Dom. He's associated, well, that's his recording studio, that he's also associated with Poet Records. Next week, we'll be talking to him to learn more about that. In the meantime, what's up for moi this weekend? Well, starting here on weekend eve tonight, we have to go back to our wine bar. We've been hitting that pretty regularly lately. But if you recall, we had a guest, oh, goodness gracious, back in the summertime, I think it was, by the name of Ruben Rodriguez, because we had been like 3 weeks in a row, and each week it was a trio. And it's like, well, who's this bass player that's always in it? So I introduced myself, and then we had him on. Just a riot of a time. Now, tonight, at our wine bar, it's the Ruben Rodriguez trio, so we gotta catch that. Tomorrow night, your ruggedly handsome trivia host will be back in T, South Dakota at the Sky Lounge, and our theme is It's All Golden. What could that mean? And then Saturday night, Boss's Comedy has Cody Lindenberger performing. So there you have it. Hope you've enjoyed this show as well as I have had the fun of putting it together for you and our guests again. Fantastic. Thank you, Claire Lockhart and Travis Nye. Thank you again for all you do. It helps me out. And remember, I'm Dave Holly, and for me, every day is a holiday.
The Dave Holly Hour has been brought to you by the Sky Lounge and Tea, XL Chiropractic, Quality Nails, and Books and Brews Pizzeria. If you would like to contribute to the continued success of this podcast, go to DaveHollyHour.com. At the bottom of the front page is the additional links section. Click on the orange button, Dave Holly on Linktree. You can order merchandise, become a Dave Holly Hour VIP, and make contributions to the show. The Dave Holly Hour is produced in the Dipsy Doodle Studios by Big D Entertainment.
Thanks for listening.